Number five is to share control and be accountable. Now, if someone else other than me were here talking about outrage management, they might or might not put the kind of emphasis I have put on giving away credit. I think giving away credit is absolutely essential. I think pretty much everybody agrees with me that it helps, but not everybody puts the emphasis on it that I put on it. Everybody emphasizes sharing control. I mean, if there is a universal solvent in addressing outraged publics, it is sharing control. And there's absolutely universal agreement that it's virtually impossible to reduce outrage without a reallocation of control of some sort. And the metaphor that's usually used for sharing control is driving, so I will use it also. Will you raise your hand if you feel safer behind the wheel of a car than you do in the passenger seat? Nearly all the hands are up, and that's consistent with the data. I don't have Australian data. In the U.S., 85% of people with driver's licenses consider themselves better than average drivers. Now, that's a sizable optimistic bias. What percentage is actually better than average? 50. And 50% are worse than average, and one hypothetical person is exactly average. So if 85% consider themselves better than average and only 50% can be better than average, that's a huge bias. That's a huge optimistic bias hooked to control. If you let me drive, I feel much safer. Okay. So if you want me to feel safer, let me drive. Okay. Or if you can't bear to let me drive, let me help drive. Let me get my hand on the steering wheel, too. Now, I want to give you another example of much the same thing. Chauncey Starr, who created this example, used to do both technical work and risk communication work for the electric power industry. He has passed away. But this is a terrific example. And once you hear this example, you will never forget the importance of control in what risk means to people. What I want you to do is imagine yourself slicing a rib roast. Okay, if anybody here is a vegetarian, you can imagine slicing a large piece of tofu. Okay. And this is an informal occasion. You have no fork. Okay. So one hand is right on the meat, and the other hand is carving. And I want you to get a kinesthetic vision, a picture in your head, of how close to the knife the hand on the meat is as you cut. Really picture it. Okay, everybody got it? Now, let's make it a two-person job. Give somebody else the knife. What happens to the hand on the meat? Right. Pulls back. Either that or you get a fork. And that's universal, so risk assessors try to make sense out of it. They say, well, the feedback loop is more complex with two cerebrums than with one cerebrum, okay, which is their quaint way of saying it takes less time to quit cutting than it does to say, that's my finger. Or, that was my finger. And that's true, but we intuitively know it's not why our hand pulls back. We don't think, oh, dear, the feedback loop just got more complex. The reason our hand pulls back is most of us figure as long as we have the knife, the risk to all the fingers in the neighborhood is pretty low. But as soon as you have to give the knife to somebody else, the risk to neighborhood fingers has just gone up. That's true even if you give the knife to a friend or neighbor. It's much truer if you give the knife to a faceless bureaucratic regulatory agency, and it's truest of all if you give the knife to a multinational corporation. In risk controversies between Rio Tinto and your stakeholders, you're holding the knife. They're holding the meat. They, in fact, feel they are the meat. And you're not just holding the knife, you're waving it around like a chef in a Japanese restaurant, all the time insisting it's safe, it's safe, it's safe. And it is safe as long as you've got the knife. Okay? But it's a lot less safe if you've got the meat. Okay? So the lesson is the same as driving. Share the knife. Let me get my hands on the knife as well. And this is in large measure what community advisory panels are about. They're not only about watching while you flail. They are about helping you flail. Okay? And thus sharing in control. It's not hard to think of ways to share control. The problem is it's hard to want to share control. So there is an alternative to sharing control, and that's accountability. Accountability is a genuine compromise. It reduces your stakeholders' outrage less, but it arouses your own outrage less as well. And since control is a zero-sum game, and in some ways outrage is a zero-sum game, if your company is unwilling to share control or unable to share control, accountability is a pretty decent halfway measure. And just to make sure the point is clear, let me go back to driving. If sharing control is letting me drive or letting me help drive, accountability is letting me backseat drive. Okay? You let me sit in the backseat, watch you drive, and yell at you that you're a lousy driver. Now, most people don't like enduring backseat drivers, but if your only choice is either to endure the backseat driver or to let the backseat driver drive, most of us would prefer to keep the backseat driver in the backseat. And I am arguing that that's your only choice. Some combination of sharing control and being accountable is going to be essential. So let me go back to the hypothetical example I've used several times. Somebody has accused you of contaminating the groundwater. Okay. So you do a study, and you find that the groundwater isn't contaminated, and you announce that the groundwater isn't contaminated. What happens? People don't believe you. Okay. The fox is guarding the hen house, they say. Why should we trust your study on your contamination? So you understand that, so you hire a consulting firm. And the consulting firm does the study, and they announce that their study has revealed that the groundwater isn't contaminated. Now what do people say? You paid for them. They know what side their bread is buttered on. Okay. Now, let me tell you, that suspicion is extremely well justified. In the social science of science, very few findings are as well established as the very strong correlation between the findings of studies on controversial topics and the preferences of the funders of those studies. That relationship is statistically significant at p less than 0.0001, okay? Which is to say it is vanishingly unlikely that it could happen by chance. In the vast majority of cases, researchers reach conclusions that their funder can live with. This is not because researchers cheat. This is because the research process is pretty subjective. How you define your hypotheses, how you develop your methodologies, how you use, what kind of analytic tools you use in a variety of ways, the process is subjective. And because it's subjective, without being consciously dishonest, you can, as a researcher, usually find something that your funder can live with. This is sometimes called the Ouija board phenomenon. Okay, that the research process has a lot of Ouija board in it, and you can make it come out as a researcher the way the funder would like to see it come out, and you do that without consciously cheating. So if your critics do a study and they find that you have contaminated the groundwater, you are right to say, come on, give me a break, that's the critic's study. Even if they hire a consultant, you are right not to trust the study. And if you do a study or you hire a consultant, your critics are right not to trust your study. So what do you do if you want to do a study that's trustworthy? Okay. I mean, double blind is the gold standard in science. But even double blind, first of all, double blind is not often possible in the kinds of studies we're talking about. But also, even double blind isn't trustworthy because we don't know if you actually did it double blind or if you opened your eyes, when they were supposed to be closed. So it's not, even double blind is not credible. So what do you do? Get the regulator to appoint a consultant helps a little, but only a little, unless the regulator is a very hostile regulator, in which case it might help a good deal. I mean, if you can have a study done by someone who hates you, who will nonetheless do an honest study, That's terrific. But someone who hates you is, you know, the research says, is unlikely to do an honest study. They will do a biased study against you. You will do a biased study in support of you. So what you do if you don't want a biased study is you reach out to your critics and you say, we're going to have to sponsor this study jointly. Okay. We'll jointly pick the consultant. We'll jointly write the terms of reference. We'll jointly supervise the work. Okay. And if you're smart, you go one step further and you jointly interpret the data before you have any data. Okay. You do that using dummy tables. So in advance of having any results, you have agreed, if it comes out looking like this, we're going to agree that it's contaminated. If it comes out looking like this, we're going to agree that it's clean. If it comes out looking like this, we're going to say, hey, that's pretty clean, and you're going to say not clean enough. And you negotiate those boundaries before you start collecting data. What you're doing is you are giving up the opportunity to cheat, in return for which your critics are giving up the opportunity to claim you're cheating. Now, listen carefully. If you're cheating, this is not good advice to take. Okay? Dishonest research should always be done unilaterally. But if you're not cheating, if you don't want to reserve the opportunity to cheat just in case it comes out wrong, you know, if you are confident enough that you're right or honest enough that you're willing to let the chips fall where they may in case you're wrong, and you don't want to reserve the chance to cheat, not even to cheat unconsciously using the Ouija board phenomenon to your advantage, then this should be a no-brainer. Give up the chance to cheat, which you plan not to use, and in return, force your critics to give up the chance to claim you're cheating, which they use all the time. This should be obvious. Why isn't it? What's the barrier? Why is this so hard for companies to make themselves do? Sometimes it's because they're cheating. You know, and they want to keep cheating. But sometimes I have honest clients, in my judgment, clients I think are honest, that are still unwilling to create these kind of accountability mechanisms. Any idea why? It's partly about control, absolutely. It's partly about control. And the other piece of it, I think, and my guess is, I don't have data on this, but my guess is the bigger piece of it is ego. In order to wrap your mind around the idea that you should do accountable research, you must first wrap your mind around the idea that lots of people believe that if you can cheat, you will cheat. And I have clients that find that idea so offensive that they insist on preserving the right to cheat so that they cannot use it and feel virtuous. A very high price to pay for self-esteem, especially, you know, I mean, everybody thinks they're cheating, and probably unconsciously they are. I mean, that's what the data says, is unconsciously they are almost certainly cheating. What makes this stunning to me, and this is the last thing we'll say, or almost the last thing I'll say before the break, what makes this stunning to me is it's not as if Rio Tinto were averse to accountability mechanisms. Rio Tinto uses accountability mechanisms, and all companies use accountability mechanisms all the time. I mean, if your company is going to buy a smaller company or buy an asset from another company, you do your due diligence. You send in your accountants, you send in your lawyers, you send in everybody. Similarly, if you're writing a big contract with a supplier, you write accountability clauses into that contract. You write inspection clauses of various kinds into that contract. And if the takeover target or the supplier said, oh, come on, we don't need all of that, let's just trust each other, you would see that as a huge red flag. And you would say, are you kidding? We're talking about money here. We have no intention of trusting each other. And you don't trust them, and you don't consider that an insult, and you allow them not to trust you, and you don't consider that an insult either. Mutual accountability is how you do business. But suddenly, it's not a takeover target. It's not a contractor. It's an NGO. It's a community. It's an Aboriginal group. And suddenly, you are incredibly offended that they don't trust you, as if trust were your normal way of doing business. Okay. Accountability is your normal way of doing business. And when you are unwilling to build accountability mechanisms into your relationship with some particular group, they experience that as evidence that you don't consider them to be players at all. Everybody who's a player gets to hold all the other players accountable. And when you're not willing to let Aboriginals hold you accountable, or not willing to let activist groups hold you accountable, what you're communicating is they shouldn't be in the game. And they experience that, I think, accurately as a very powerful piece of disrespect, as an effort to exclude them from a process. Everyone else gets to hold everyone else accountable. And if you can build accountability into your relationships with NGOs and with Aboriginals and with all the groups that you are reluctant to be accountable to, you're good at accountability mechanisms. You know how to do that. You've got more lawyers than you know what to do with who are expert at accountability mechanisms. And the problem, and I think Rio has made a lot of progress on this issue, so I don't want to talk as if you guys hadn't made progress, but the problem for those companies that aren't able to let their community critics hold them accountable, okay, is a very ironic problem. If they can use the same accountability mechanisms they use with competitors and contractors and use them with community groups, they can make extremely significant progress in reducing those groups' outrage. Comments and questions? Yes, sir.
The last one about controlling accountability and specifically talking about the Aboriginal communities. One of the issues we have quite a bit is that the community is not necessarily willing or able to take up the control of accountability. So, for instance, the example I was using before was the desire to increase employment within our business, which is employment, where the problem is all ours, and the mutual accountability is.
Yeah, I haven't got a solution to that. I mean, I think you're absolutely right. There are, you know, sometimes you become willing to be accountable and you find that they are either not willing to hold you accountable or not able to do so. You gave the example of employment, but, you know, very straightforward accountability mechanisms. I mean, you can decide, all right, I'm going to put this activist group, which I hate, on my advisory committee. Much as I hate them, I've decided to let them be part of the accountability system and sit on my advisory committee. And you finally get up the courage, or self-abnegation that it takes to call your worst enemy and say, please sit on my advisory committee. And she says no. You know, and she says no for pretty good reasons, because it may be better in her, more in her interest to stay outside the meeting and attack you. Lyndon Johnson said years ago of a political enemy, I would rather have him inside the tent pissing out than outside the tent pissing in. So it's always in your interest to get them in, but it's not always in their interest to come in. It may be in their interest to stay out and give you, criticism without being part of your accountability structure. So it gets very frustrating when you're finally willing to do it and they are not. And as you say, sometimes they're not willing because they're not willing. Sometimes it's consultation fatigue. There are just too many consultations you want them to do all at the same time. And companies, I don't know if this is you always, but companies very often will, work on something for years and then suddenly want to have a public consultation that's extremely intense and lasts weeks. And their schedule may not be compatible with that. They may not want to consult at the last minute intensively. So I mean, I think there are all kinds of reasons why sometimes you can't get the accountability mechanisms you want.